And welcome to this edition of Talking History.
A special live edition today.
Yes, indeed, because on the line we have with us Professor Kevin Wilmot, who is a professor of film at the University of Kansas. And he is with us today to talk about his films, and particularly one of his films, CSA, the Confederate States of America. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, how you guys doing?
Wonderful, and so good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin, you do some incredible filmmaking, some very unique filmmaking. Maybe you can describe your film. I don't want to describe it. I don't want to do it myself. I'm going to have you describe your film.
Okay.
And then I'm going to ask you some questions about how you came to make this film.
Sure. Well, I appreciate that. The CSA, Confederate States of America, is what I guess I call a faux documentary, a fake documentary, that examines what happens when the South wins the Civil War. And we examine it from their victory at Gettysburg all the way to today, and slavery continues into the modern world. And we made the film as a like you're sitting at home in the Confederacy today. It's no longer the USA, it's the CSA, and you're watching television and you get to see this Ken Burns kind of style documentary on probably their I don't know if they would have PBS in the Confederacy, but anyway, they're watching it on their television, and you get to see the entire history of the nation, including commercials and promos for their culture, the present day culture.
Now it's supposedly a British documentary.
Yes,
that is being shown in the CSA for the first time. It's a prohibited film, apparently.
Yes, well, the BBS has come to the Confederacy to make this film, and it was controversial for a number of reasons, and has been held and finally released after holding it for a couple of years, and so it's a big network debut.
It's an incredibly powerful film. I can't imagine a white filmmaker getting away with this. You are a black filmmaker. Do you think that your race made a difference in whether you could take on this project or not?
Well, yeah, and I think that's kind of part of the point also of the film, you know, is that, you know, a white filmmaker that would have the same kind of point of view as I do, that was really trying to you know, make positive steps toward, you know, race relations, trying to make people embrace the history, understand the history, as I like to call it, kind of take ownership of the history. You know, couldn't do that in this country because we've got such unfinished business in terms of race still kind of hanging around our necks. And so in some ways, I think that's one of the best examples of why I kind of made the film.
I think so too. I think it's I've seen some mockumentaries or faux documentaries, but I think this is one of the most powerful pieces that I've ever seen.
Oh, I thank you very much for that.
And I teach documentary filmmaking at the University of Albany. Besides history, I'm a historian, but I also teach documentary studies. And one of the things I love about your film is that there is so much reality in this fiction that you present. There is so many pieces of our society and our past which you exaggerate, you distort, but yet you get at the essence of the contradictions that we live every day in this country. I think that your selection, could you talk a little bit about the selection? I mean, you've got things like the CBI, the Confederate Bureau of Investigation.
Sure.
You have the piece on the system of apart in Mexico. You have the flight of Frederick Douglass and Lincoln to Canada. Why did you pick certain things, certain themes, certain topics, and not others in the film?
Sure. Well, one of the criteria I kind of laid out for myself was that early on, in the earlier drafts of the film, I when I was writing it, you know, I kind of was doing more of the Archie Bunker style of humor, you know, where you would kind of wink at the camera and kind of say, we're just joking, folks. And the problem with that for me was I didn't believe it, you know, and I wanted the history to be believable. I wanted to kind of bring into the world of the Confederacy, and even though it seems kind of outlandish and crazy on the surface, I wanted to show kind of how history affects our lives today. And so the criteria for the choices really always was, ended up being, is it true? Is it true in some kind of present-day way? You know, I mean, that's the thing I think that's so important about history, is that the more you understand history, the more you understand how you live today, the more you understand what's going on today. And, you know, there's nothing new. You know, everything's been done before. And so, you know, you want to try to, I tried to find choices, you know, in the film that really, you know, have been the things that have really, you know, determined how we live. And so, you know, I call them the signposts of history, really. You know, those signposts that have really constructed, you know, our society and affected leadership and all of those things. So that was really the big thing in terms of, you know, where the choices came from. You know, I wanted to deal with the Depression. I wanted to deal with World War II. I wanted to deal with the Kennedy assassination. You know, I wanted to deal with, you know, the Civil Rights Movement in a very bizarre kind of way, how we deal with it in the CSA. And, you know, all of those things are the major kind of moments. And it allowed me also, I think, to not get caught up in the minutia of things. You know, there's so many things you can deal with. And so when you kind of limit yourself to the kind of the big signpost, it gives you kind of a clear vision.
I think that I didn't know where to begin this interview, because there's so much. It's a rich film, and it introduces incredible themes. I'm just going to pick and choose the themes.
Sure.
You deal with racist science and the relationship between racism and science in this piece. Can you talk a little bit about the dreptomania, particularly?
Well, I ran across this book called Cotton is King, and it was written in 1859. And it's a huge book that basically has all of the Confederacy's, you know, justification theories of why slavery was a good thing and should continue. And it had the psychological, the scientific, the economic, the religious, everything. And that's the thing that really kind of, I think, Americans don't fully understand about the CSA. You know, that it was a real nation, and it had real thought behind it, and it had real philosophy and real leadership, and it grew out of the construction of the USA. You know, one of the things I kind of you know, discovered along the way was, in many ways, I think we started out as the CSA, and that's why I think Southerners were so ticked at us when we told them to free the slaves, was that, you know, we had always told them that slavery was okay and that their way of life was okay. And then Abraham Lincoln comes along and says, no, you got to change things now. And so you kind of see that there was a huge justification system that was part of the CSA. And you can understand why even still today people still hold on to it and want to believe in it in various ways. And that's the thing that I think Americans don't kind of fully understand. You know, they think it was some kind of little mistake that was made, like this bad misunderstanding, you know. And it was far deeper than that, you know. And for me, the scientific part of it, I think, is one of the best examples. Dreptomania, which was a theory that you know, that Dr. Samuel A. Cartwright constructed from the University of Louisiana, believed that slaves ran away because of a disease, and they could be cured from this disease, and they believed that, and they had other things like nigritude and rascality and things like that were all what they called freedom diseases, you know, and these freedom diseases were, you know, what they believed in terms of why, you know, slaves acted the way they did. If they were uncooperative or tried to run away or were combative or anything, this was a disease. One of the things I think that's so important about that is that it really kind of links the Confederacy to Nazi Germany and all the justification devices that the Nazis had to exterminate the Jews. And I don't think we like to think of it that way in America. You know, part of it is that it's much easier to kind of make moral judgment on the Nazis because they're in another country. But we had the same devices, the same systematic kind of construction right here in America.
Absolutely. And I was going to ask you if you mind if we play selections from the film,
sure,
just
go
the
right
audio
ahead.
Selection of the film. I was going to do the draped media part, but I think you described it very well. And I think it's for those of us who know a little bit about racial science in the late 19th and early 20th century, it was obviously something that spread into the North. And the notions of racial differences and brain sizes and head sizes and all of that type of science that went on at the time was pervasive in the United States. But I want to talk a little bit about the whole notion of Reconstruction and how you reverse it, and how the South attempts to reconstruct the North and bring them into the Union. And so I'm going to play a section in which the Davis Plan is described. Then you can comment on it. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay.
The Davis Plan took the form of an income tax designed to rebuild the North. Still, former Unionists did have another option.
The entire tax, collected only from former Union citizens, could be abated with the purchase of household or industrial slaves. The choice was yours.
To manage the plan, Davis selected Congressman John Ambrose Fauntroy.
The rest of it is visual, but the Davis Plan talks about how slavery was spread to the North in order to involve Northerners in the culture, to bring them into the culture. Where did you get this idea?
Well, a lot of it was I was influenced by the book Race and Reunion by David Blight.
Yes.
And that, I think that's a really terrific, important book. And it really kind of, I think, lays out what happened after the Civil War, how the North and the South had to reunite, and they reunited, they connected back at the expense of the memory of slavery. And, you know, that's how the war becomes about states' rights, that's how the war becomes about economics, that's how the war becomes about industrial and agricultural. And so slavery is removed from the equation so that we can become friends again. I mean, one of the best examples is where I live, Lawrence, Kansas, Bleeding Kansas, where John Brown is, and Missourians are coming across the border into Kansas, you know, burning down Lawrence. We're going over, burning down Missouri towns, killing people. And how do you get these people to have friends, to become friends after the war? I mean, brothers have been killing brothers, neighbors killing neighbors. And so you have them become friends, you know, by removing what the differences were, and the differences were slavery. And I think that's the thing that Americans don't fully understand, you know, about the Civil War, that the reason that we don't know much about slavery as Americans is that because they didn't want us to know, you know, and that the choice that I make in the film of the income tax is kind of trying to link it to a modern connection today, how a lot of choices are made today for us in terms of selling them to the American public by we're not going to raise taxes, or we're going to give you a tax break. And so moral kind of decisions are made on our behalf, and really kind of ethical choices are made on our behalf and sold to us through the use of taxes. And so that was really where I, you know, came up with that choice. So again, trying to link the past with the present in different ways.
Yeah, I was astounded at the number of historical references, authentic historical references, and how much research you had to do to really be able to reverse these. How much research? What was the research that went into this film? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, you know, I've always been a history nut, but I think for me it was always about what I like to call the living history of it all. You know, history for me is very much, you know, an ongoing living thing. And, you know, you try to find the things in our history that really make people feel it. And for me, that's what the CSA was all about. The film was an attempt to make people feel the history. And that's the hard thing about history. History becomes so dry and so removed and so remote. And it's not. You know, it is this living, amazing thing. And what the filmmaker, the dramatist, has to try to find a way to do is make you feel it. And so, you know, we made these choices in an attempt at hopefully make you kind of experience what it's all about through, you know, as to be a slave in the CSA, to be a citizen in the CSA, all those kind of things. And I think, you know, the best parts of the film, I think, do that in various ways.
And we'll get to some some more of those. One of the things, there's so many things that I really liked about the film. One of the lovely pieces that you do is the reversal of Gone with the Wind, how the North, how the South romanticized its past, and how actually the North and the South began to romanticize its past, blocking out slavery, reducing its virulent elements, and how you created this other film, A Northern Wind, which tries to romanticize the North, the CSA attempting to bring in the North by suggesting that they had a heroic fight, etc. you're laughing at that. I guess you really like doing that, huh?
I still get a big kick about that.
Uh-huh.
We had a lot of fun shooting that, and you know, it is funny. It's ridiculous when you really get down to it. That, mm-hmm. but it still works today. You know, I mean, Gone with the Wind is such an effective way of making Northerners and Americans as a whole feel the pain of what it was to be a white slave owner.
Right, right.
And there are no slaves in that movie that want to be free. There are no slaves that fight for their freedom. There are only slaves that fight for the Confederacy. There's a section on the DVD called The Lumber Mill that I think is really important for people to watch. And we have to watch it very closely. Because in the section on the DVD of Gone with the Wind called The Lumber Mill is the creation of the Ku Klux Klan. But it's off screen. And you have to watch very closely. So it's, in many ways, you know, Gone with the Wind is Birth of a Nation light. And we never see it as that. But that's exactly what it is.
That's actually the way I teach it. I teach them both together in my Reconstruction class in the post-Reconstruction era. But you're absolutely right. Very much so.
Yeah, and it's really, I think, one of the things that has set back race relations in this country in terms of black folks and white folks, both of us, understanding slavery more than anything. I mean, I remember as a kid seeing that film and kind of, you know, and not identifying with the black people in the movie at all. That, you know, like, I was not black. I was not them. I'm Rhett, you know? I'm the mm-hmm. guy that's going to get the girl. I'm not Polk, or I'm not, you know, Mammy, you know, and it, I think that's how it affected black folks as a whole. You know, there was this kind of weird kind of disconnect that we had with the film, that we watch it and kind of enjoy it, but not really seeing ourselves in it in this weird kind of way, and mm-hmm. almost like the history doesn't affect us, this doesn't involve us. And so it's that section of the film, that Reconstruction section, is really important, because that was how, you know, the South was brought back into the United States, and how black folks were really kind of excluded from America at that point.
Right, and you deal so well, I think, with the complicity of everyone, the churches, Jews, Africans. Who cooperate in the slave trade, the servant who suggested the idea
right,
to Davis
the servant,
in the
yes.
first place of the Davis plan.
Right,
so
yes.
So nobody is off the hook in your film.
No, that's one of the things that's I think kind of controversial about the movie. I mean, you know, I think one of the things I don't like about the way many Hollywood films kind of approach race is they like to kind of give you the moral upper hand. They like to give they make the audience feel like they're not racist, you know? And we're all racist. It's a disease we've all inherited, and it's a constant fight that you have to fight against it to understand it, all of those things. And our film, we kind of lampoon, and we kind of show there's no innocent bystanders, you know, that we're all involved in this in various ways, and especially today. You know, it gets more complicated, not less complicated. It becomes more complicated today. So, you know, yeah, I'm really glad you caught that, because that's one of the things that I think sometimes the film is criticized by people who we didn't make feel okay, you know, and they want to, they understand that they understand racism as a bad thing, but we don't make you feel okay with that.
Right.
And that's, That's one of the things I think is kind of unique about them.
Well, I think because you cast such a wide net, you couldn't be blamed for scapegoating any particular demons in the film. And I think that's what I think you made good choices there, really good choices as a filmmaker.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that. I think that that's one of the things that is the challenge for us as Americans today. You know, is that we've got to start dealing with it in real ways and in real terms, and in ways that we really gain a better understanding about these issues, and not. It's just really easy to attack the redneck, you know, and and make him the problem. But it's just more complicated than that. I think the IMUS whole thing recently kind of showed you how complicated it is now. I mean, it's very complicated, and people are still being affected and destroyed. Careers are destroyed by this history. And because we don't have ownership of it, and we don't have control of it, we can't talk about it in clear terms that everyone can kind of understand and everyone can relate to. You know, IMUS thinks that he's, you know, free to say certain things because he thinks other people are saying certain things. At least that's his justification. And all of that, in the end, comes from slavery.
Yes, I guess it does. One of the lovely things you do in the film, the powerful things you do in the film, is talk about organizations from the CBI, the Confederate Bureau of Investigation, to organizations like the Office of Racial Identity, which polices the crime of passing and racial passing, and and lampoon our commercial society with the slave shopping network, where you can purchase blacks on TV and on the internet. You use that in your commercials. Tell us about how you use commercials in this film. Very creative.
Well, you know, a big part of how everything is sold to us today is through, you know, consumerism. And people say, well, you know, could slavery really exist in the modern world? And when I started to really think hard about that issue, and I think all of us like to think we're just better than that. You know, all that would just, we would know, we just wouldn't do that. We're just better than that. Well, I don't think so. You know, I mean, I don't want to sound cynical. It doesn't come out of cynicism. It comes out of, again, the choice came out of what we did do. We still had slavery in South Africa in the 1980s. And Britain and America, you know, were both part of that. And so were other countries. And so were a lot of corporations. And so they kept the apartheid regime in power. There's sex slaves today. There's slavery in the Sudan, and there's not much we can do about it. You know, there's not much at least we are doing about it. And so it, you know, slavery is a reality, and it takes on various forms. And I think that, you know, when you look at the consumerism of how racism was sold as consumer products in this country, that's one of the ways I think racism really spread in this country and became such a a concrete part of American society was through consumerism and through these products, you know, the Gold Dust Twins and you know, Darkie toothpaste and all of these things that just became, you know, Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben, you know, just became a regular part of our lives. And so this thing of slavery just becomes part of our lives. And so that, I thought, was a key component to kind of making all of this believable for the audience, you know, that you can't deny the products that still exist today and how, and their connection with slavery and how we're still saying that's kind of okay in some kind of way. You know, I love, the, quote by, I can't think of his name right now. He, the syndicated columnist, and he talks about how Gone with the Wind was a romance set in Auschwitz. And, you know, the fact that Auschwitz also turned people into products. And that link again of taking the pain and misery of others and turning it into products. And I wanted to show kind of that connection and how today similar products could be designed, new products would be designed, the shackle.
Yes.
And pharmaceutical drugs would be created to keep people in check, you know, and keep slaves in line. And so, you know, all of that, I think, is very much a real part of our world, in many different ways. And so to deny that it could exist is to deny that it's existing now. And we don't like to think of history that way, but that's what history kind of really is.
Right. And the mixing of real products that were marketed with fictional products, I think, was very powerful. And at the end, your listing of what was actually marketed and when it was marketed, I think, was very, very nice ending to the piece.
I appreciate that. That I think is the thing that really gives people a shock at the end when they find out. I don't want to give too much away, but they find out
yes.
that all of this is true. And for me, that was the thing that justified all the choices, was that if it was true, I felt I had the right and almost an obligation to talk about it.
Yeah. As a student of the Cold War, I especially appreciated your treatment of that period with the House Committee on Racial Identity, and I Married an Abolitionist. That was wonderful. Well, could you describe that scene, maybe?
Sure. Well, it is a kind of a Invasion of the Body Snatchers type of film, designed as one of those black and white. And one of my favorite films is Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is, you know, the subtle underlying message of that film is the Cold War, you know, and McCarthyism. And I wanted, one of the very interesting films that you ever get a chance to check out, I'm sure you've probably seen it. It's a film called Santa Fe Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And in Santa Fe Trail, they talk about abolitionist agents. And when I saw the film, and the abolitionists are the bad guys in the movie, and John Brown is the bad guy. And when you watch that film, and you start to clearly see how they link abolitionism with communism, you know, and that, and they talk about abolitionist agents. And that was a big influence on me, because that's the thing that I think, when Dr. King in the Civil Rights Movement, when he's trying to change things in this country, often he's called a communist. Obviously, he had no links to communism. But that was always the argument against you. And so trying to weave that reality again into how the CSA would look at abolitionists in Canada, Red Canada, you know, there's always a way to take people, nations, and turn and demonize them and sell it back to the public and make you believe that these people are out to get you. And there may be some truth to it, but, you know, how much of it is true, and in what way is it true? And those are the hard questions you gotta ask. And often those questions aren't the ones that we ask very often. And so, you know, all of that was, again, woven in there to show how, again, this could be a very believable scenario.
And John F. Kennedy becomes a Republican in your story. But still committed to furthering the rights of blacks in his own way?
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, with Abraham Lincoln being a Republican and no FDR, you know, you don't get the switch. You don't get the switch right. from blacks turning to Democrat. And so, you know, Abraham Lincoln is the signpost that's defining, you know, black Republicans as the term was back in the days. And that's what they call Kennedy when he runs, as a black Republican. And I thought that was, you know, an important link. Obviously, you know, blacks loved John F. Kennedy. We had a photograph of, you know, we had the obligatory, you know, Kennedy, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King painting in our home that almost all black people had in the 60s. And it was just a big part, you know, his memory, what he stood for, all of those things is a big part of American black life. And I think, you know, American life as a whole. And so, you know, I wanted to clearly kind of show the link with that.
And you did. But I could go on, but our time is almost done. I just want to remind people that we are talking to a wonderful filmmaker, Kevin Wilmot from the University of Kansas in the film department. He has produced a number of films, but we're focusing today on CSA, the Confederate States of America, and that's going to be shown at on this Friday. That's tomorrow evening at 7:30 p.m. at the Old County Courthouse in Elizabethtown, New York. And that's part of a celebration, the John Brown Day celebration, celebrating the anniversary of John Brown's birth on May 9th, 1800. And on the following day, you're going to be talking, right, at John Brown's farm?
Yes, I'll be speaking, and I really look forward to that. It's always great to being there with it with John Brown will be really special. You know, he was the first screenplay I wrote was that I sold to Hollywood to 20th Century Fox was on John Brown, the abolitionist, and so he's a real special person for me.
I really look forward to meeting you personally and watching the movie once again with the audience, and especially hopefully there'll be time for a discussion, because I think your film is a film that begs discussion.
Oh, it's all about discussion.
It's all about discussion.
It's all about
absolutely
discussion. That's right.
And so I really look forward to the discussion that takes place after the film. And I wish we had time to get into the millions of other themes that are deep in this film, but it's a very rich film, and it's now going to be incorporated into my course. I want you to know that.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
So thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule and talking to us, and have a very safe flight to our wonderful state, and I look forward to meeting you tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.